KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time our guest, Alex Borstein, was here, I described her as an actor, a producer, a writer. She had yet to emerge as a director, and more importantly, as a singer, which she shows in her new special on Amazon, Corsets and Clown Suits. And of course, her success on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I'm talking to Alex Borstein. Alex, thanks for doing the show again.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And it's so interesting because the last time you were here, you were talking about your family a little bit and doing your impression of your grandmother in front of your grandmother. And now we get to see the impression of your grandmother in front of an audience.
Yeah, we've come full circle, haven't we? The beginning of my, I guess, you know, career or really being a performer was, you know, doing impersonations of my grandma and having that second language in my ear. And so it really has kind of come full circle.
But I guess what's interesting is that in a lot of ways, the special is clearly openly autobiographical, but suddenly in kind of sort of subtextual terms, it's autobiographical too. And I'm thinking about this kind of explosion of 70s and 80s British pop that pervades the show.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The guys that you see in the show with me, Eric and Salva, a lot of those songs are some that I missed. Like, I really didn't know a lot of The Cure. The LCD sound system was brand new to me. Like, I really didn't discover LCD sound system till much later in my life, which is so bizarre. People were like, how did you not know this? So it's interesting. They're like oldies to many ears, but to me, they were like brand new, interesting songs that I was hearing for the first time.
Well, but I kind of, well, maybe my favorite thing is sort of the medley of Kiss Sauce and She Bangs.
That's a fun one. Makes no sense, but boy, was it fun.
Well, I guess in meter, it kind of makes sense. But I want you to talk a little bit about this show, just because it starts off with you talking about perception. And even the bit of burlesque we get at the beginning that sets the show up is about perception, too, about not seeing what you think you're going to see and reacting to what's not in front of you. And it's a really intriguing sort of metaphor to play out throughout the show.
It's kind of something that from day one, I've always been slightly obsessed with, like how I'm perceived and trying to let go of that. I think doing the show allowed me to do that. In the end, it's a little bit like, this is it. This is what I have to offer. And it's none of my business after it comes out of me. It's how anything is perceived afterwards. It's not up to me. And there's nothing you can do to control that.
There's a line at the beginning, near the beginning of the show, that sent a chill through me. And I wanted to ask you about its origin, because something you kind of got at when we were talking about your role in Getting On the last time you were here. You talk about a woman basically being seen when she makes herself smaller.
No, it's very true. I mean, now with the advent of social media and it being in our faces 24/7, it's even more true that women spend, I would say, 20 hours of their 24 each day trying to make themselves smaller, whether it's in their weight, exercising, working out, dieting, you know, taking medication to do so. It's an obsession to make yourself smaller. And if it's not physical, it's to be perceived as smaller, to kind of keep quiet, to be sweet and to not make waves. It's kind of what a lot of girls are taught from a very early age.
Again, I want to find out how far back this goes, because it certainly seems to dovetail in some ways with your work, you should say your Emmy-winning work on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. But that's also about an era, too, about characters choosing not to be diminished by the world, but rather being who they are.
Yeah, and choosing to take up space in a world that otherwise does not want to let them do so. I think Midge's character is super interesting for that, because she walks the line. You know, she's corseted. I mean, poor Rachel, every day on that set was bound and gagged pretty much by her wardrobe. And yet, you know, her mouth betrays her. And I love that about the show. I love that this woman at the center of it is doing all those other things right and playing by all of those rules and measuring her thigh and measuring her waist, but speaking freely and taking center stage. It's a really cool juxtaposition.
But also, too, the last time we were here, I remember we were talking about the idea of women being presentational versus being who they are, and the way that kind of was kind of thematic in the show Getting On. And here, your character is determinately not presentational. In fact, I probably can't think of another woman character who's worn the same shoes over most of the five seasons of a show that she's done.
But they were very fancy shoes. It's a, the original boots that I wore for the first season or two were the costume designers. They're from her personal closet.
Wow.
These kind of banged up, ankle-high, almost like motorcycle boots, you know? But yeah, the character who almost like a cartoon character in that sense, where you're in the same outfit every single time you see them. And I love it. I love that distraction is completely removed. Susie dresses as a form of armor. You know, she dresses to protect herself. There's a leather jacket, a belt, and suspenders just in case. And then she moves into a vest and the hat and is able to kind of take on the world that way. She sees it, I think, as a bit of armor.
I guess I was just thinking about the two and watching you on the special, which is really terrific, by the way, in the way that you sort of take up space on the stage and the calculation and watching you sort of occupy center stage and then moving downstage to connect a little bit with audience members. And it's interesting watching you in this space that belongs to you, the way you inhabit it, as compared to when you're playing characters.
Yeah, it was actually interesting being on that stage. You know, that was the theater that was built for Midge Maisel. The burlesque shows were at the fictional Wolford Theater, and it was built for Midge. And it was really fun to, like, you know, I asked Amy, can we use that for my special? And she loved the idea. And it was torn down shortly thereafter, but it was a really neat experience to take up that space, to stand where Midge, a fictional character, had stood before and kind of make it my own. And yeah, it's terrifying being solo on the stage, but it's also invigorating, you know, when you take up that much space, it's only you to blame if it goes wrong or if something isn't well received.
This is the treatment, by the way. My guest is Emmy winner Alex Borstein. You can also see the showcase here at W.com. I guess I found myself thinking so much in watching you on the in this show. We're talking about pleasure you often get, or the pleasure we see in you as audience members, going back to Mad TV when something is really clicking. And there are a lot of moments that pleasure, at least I feel, in watching you on that stage.
Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful that it's now streaming and it came out, but really the culmination was those two shoot days. We shot it over 2 days. You know, that's the climax. That's the pleasure spot. That's like, you know, that's everything. Having that feedback from the audience live, that anything can happen, moments with the audience that happen, you know, and you're forced to kind of work off the cuff. There's nothing better than that for me. So yeah, I mean, the joy that you're seeing is very real.
Well, talk to me about how this all came into being, because again, I think of you as being so many of these things, but to have them all in one place like this, all of these things that you do, this sort of interesting kind of culmination of your life to this point, including the confessional aspects. Talk about bringing this into being.
I moved to Barcelona, as I detail in the show. And the show is, it's interesting. I always describe it as deeply personal and wildly fictitious. It is absolutely personal in telling my story, but it's also, in a way, you know, every woman's story. It's people trying to kind of start over, reinvent, and manage how they're perceived. It's very universal. And it really started when I moved to Barcelona. Getting On had been canceled. The next project I was going to do was this pilot for Fox with Alan Arkin. And that fell apart at the last minute and just kind of broke my heart. And I was just done. And my marriage was over. And I just said, like, I want to do something completely new. And I did. And I moved to Barcelona. And once I was there, I met these two guys, Eric and Salva. And they're kind of music aficionados. We met on a marijuana foggy weekend in Amsterdam. And I had never met Salva. We both knew Eric. He invited us for a birthday weekend in March, and we sat around and we played music for each other on our phones. And each one had such varying backgrounds. And then I started kind of telling some stories, and we realized this is kind of interesting. What if we do something like this together? What if, you know, you're kind of monologuing and we're playing soundtrack almost to that? And that kind of started. We got back to Barcelona and we started meeting and working together. And I think it was maybe that night listening to songs, me hearing an LCD song and then starting to sing another song over it and realizing it was the same meter and realizing it worked. And all of a sudden we had these weird medleys and mashups. And I think it maybe was born from that.
It feels really confident in its pacing and confessional to the extent that you're really talking to an audience. And again, like I was saying, this thing that I really find I like about watching you work is your delight, whether it be in character or here sort of playing a version of yourself as a character. Your sort of opening entrance, that Cleopatra like sitting on that chaise lounge, just sort of speaks to the fact that you are taking ownership of the stage, doesn't it?
And it's ludicrous in a way, which is so much fun. It was a totally silly, I mean, really the first words out of my mouth are, look at me. And it really just tickles me. It's so ridiculous. It's you know, one of my idols actually is like Steve Martin in a way. It's a very Steve Martin kind of moment when I really think about it now, that was kind of his whole bit, was like he gets on stage and it's just like, look at me, I'm doing comedy. And that's kind of what that moment feels like in many ways.
No, but sort of that also that kind of the intersection of the surreal and the silly. You know, like, again, I mean, you know, just bringing quesas, 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 and she bangs together.
Yeah, do you want to know an interesting secret about that mashup?
Yes, absolutely.
That when we originally toured it, it was Quizás and Fernando by ABBA.
Oh my God. That's actually the exact same rhythm almost.
Yes. And they would not allow us to use that song. So I had to figure out, does anything else work and what works? And lo and behold, that I think was richer. It actually worked in a better way. And as luck or maybe misfortune would have it, on the night that we shot, it was the night that poor Ricky Martin was in the news again for some salacious horribleness that was then later disproved, or I don't know, but the timing could not have been more perfect that's the song that made it into our lineup.
Well, we're talking about silliness, so I guess we'll take a break. Our guest is our thrilled to have her back here, Alex Borstein. Her new special on Amazon is The Special. Of course, it's in clown suits. Of course, we can see her in the final season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which I think is also, let me check my notes, on Amazon. We'll take a break. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. She's ready, probably born ready. Alex Borstein is my guest. Her new special for Amazon, The Confessional and Delightful Special, Corsets and Clowns. So she's also, of course, starring in the final season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is also on Amazon. What I think is so much fun about this show is it is also completely and openly political. Your common sense take on Wonder Woman and the options open to girls who want to dress as superheroes on the whole thing on Wonder Woman's powers was, I thought, one of the funniest things I'd ever heard.
You know, you're aware of all of these things, of course, growing up as a girl and then becoming a young woman and then an older woman. But it's not until you bring another girl into this world, you know, that you start to really notice these glaring, glaring problems and like these missing links in pop culture for girls. It's really something.
God, it's so interesting because just thinking about the last time we talked, and so much of what you've done as an actor and somebody who creates a lot of stuff for yourself as well is sort of making sure that we understand the character's understanding of the compromises demanded of them and how they respond to these compromises.
That's what I love so much about with Maisel, with, you know, Amy Sherman-Palladino's writing, is that she crafts these uncompromising women in a world that wants to force them to compromise. And that's what's so much fun to play. The constant banging into walls, not even ceilings, just walls. You know, it's really, it's more like a maze than it is trying to go up. It's just trying to get through. And Susie and Midge, those characters, will consistently just slam into a wall and brush themselves off and find another doorway. And that's what I love about playing that character.
But just thinking too about between Getting On and Mrs. Maisel, you got the opportunity to star in two shows where the women aren't specifically defined as foils for men. And to have that kind of stretch in their career is pretty remarkable stuff, I think.
Isn't that, I am so lucky. I really feel like I've been so blessed by the universe because, yeah, the characters on Getting On were raw and very real. And the different generations of women on that show as well, like getting to work with a lot of women in their 70s, 80s, even 90s, you know, I was in a position to learn from so many people and just, you realize nothing is permanent. You know, your age is so temporary, and that woman in the hospital bed, that's you. And that it's all of us. It's not even linear. We're all a piece of it. And that show was remarkable in that way, and getting to kind of experience that. And Maisel similarly, it's so many different women of different ages and all accomplished. And neither of those shows were about a woman chasing a guy.
It's rare that we can see a performer's pleasure in performing and not have this kind of rob us of the ability to respond in kind. You know, like sometimes you see people having fun, we kind of go, oh, okay, we just kind of write it off. But there's something, there's an empathetic nature to your pleasure that I think is really kind of remarkable and singular.
With the special, I was really insistent. It sounds trivial, but I was really insistent about like not holding a microphone and not having a headset visible. I really wanted it to just feel very impromptu and very conversational in many ways and natural, and for that fun to not have that barrier of like a mic in your hand between you. It alters all the information coming out of your mouth is altered when you're kind of presentational that way.
It's funny when you say that, because what I think of is that when somebody has a microphone or a headset and TED Talky, it feels like information rather than communication, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Exactly. It's having words spill out of your mouth and go through this microphone, hopefully hitting someone's ears in the right way. Whereas having like both of my hands available and being able to just emote and play a character, really like perform a role and not worry about any of those mechanics. It's freeing.
It's interesting because it actually made me think of going back. There used to be a time, like in public television in the 70s, they have a lot of these one-person shows that would be like that, but there wouldn't be an audience there. But there was almost like an immediate connection between the viewer and the performance, and that's what I feel we get out of this, and just the deliberation it requires. Sort of at certain points, we're seeing the entire stage, but then at points, we're just seeing you, and there isn't that kind of the reminder that we're watching a performer. It seems much more naked and vulnerable.
Yeah. And I owe a lot to the, you know, Scott Ellis, who directed it, who's one of the directors on Maisel. And he's a Tony Award winning, you know, theatrical director. And he kindly said, oh yeah, I'll do this. I'll help with this. And he was really the one that, you know, wanted to like keep it very bare and brought in the lighting guy who really created all those moods behind me just on the back of that stage. And I think that was such a great idea, just keeping it stark so that I was forced to fill the space and not rely on anything behind me or in front of me.
I mean, interesting too, because there is this sort of intersection between sort of stage and big screen that informs a lot of Maisel too. And you also had the same DP, right, from Maisel on the show?
Yeah, we had David Mullen and our camera crew and Bill Groom, production designer. I was very, very lucky to have everyone say, yeah, let's do this. I mean, it was while we were shooting. It was insane that they agreed to do it. It was, you know, I think everyone had a few days off so that we could do this. And these poor people, instead of having much needed rest, were like, okay, let's do Borstein's show now.
Well, but obviously it's about commitment to you, though, because you had to do the same thing they had to do, and you had to also sort of clear your head up enough to be able to do this thing that was a 180 from what you're doing on the show.
Yeah, but I feel very indebted to all of them for saying yes. And I think it was fun. It was such a departure, and it was, you know, filthy and rough in many ways, and loose and very different, you know, from Maisel in that regard. You know, Maisel is exactly scripted. Mine was very scripted too, but there was plenty of room for audience play and that kind of thing. So, you know, I got to hand it to Amazon because it's not really a stand-up special. It's very different. And the closest things in my head were some of my idols were like Carrie Fisher's Wishful Drinking and Sandra Bernhardt, Without You, I'm Nothing. Those were kind of like things that were swilling around in my head and inspirational. But for Prime Video, for Amazon to say, yes, let's do this very different thing, it's pretty cool that they did it.
The fun of it is just like the unapologetic bodiness mm-hmm. of both of these shows. Hearing that kind of language from a woman on a stage is still, without the modern day sort of accoutrement or microphone and those things that are telling us that it's performative, it still strikes a different kind of chord, doesn't it?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, it's not like I go into anything intending to shock or be bawdy. It's
really,
really. I mean, this is how a lot of women talk. This is how we think. This is what's going on. And the sooner we kind of start leveling the reality of what women are supposed to sound like and what women shouldn't say, I think it's going to be very hard to have a pretty equitable world, you know?
It's the treatment, my guess, is Alex Borstein, again, Emmy winner. Yeah, she's also currently starring on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon, but her special is Corsets and Clown Suits, which is also on Amazon. I guess it makes me think about how compartmentalized a lot of sort of stage performance is, where it may be one thing or the other, but not both, and not so kind of free-handed, but also it's where the proscenium are. So it is a stage and a stage show, and that makes us have certain associations, and you let us know that your parents are in the show, in the theater, I mean to say. So, you know, all these things we're saying about the bodies, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in play here that creates tensions that clearly you're aware of in this show.
Yeah, tension's good. I mean, tension is how comedy works. You know, you can't build to a laugh without it. That's what a laugh is. Laugh is like, you know, when your stomach builds up with gas, you got to let it out. And when your mind and soul kind of fills up with tension, comedy is the way to expel it. It's really healthy. It's necessary.
Gosh, it's funny because as we're talking about this, Alex, if I'm still thinking about the way that Susie paces reminds me of a stand-up, like back and forth on the stage. And when you're on stage doing this act, you don't pace. I mean, it's really interesting just sort of thinking about the differences. Obviously, you're playing a character and you're an accomplished actor. But still, I just find myself thinking about how this gives you a chance to do something that's, as you're saying, so different from the kinds of things we've seen you do before.
It's funny, Susie's pacing, I always liken her, you know, when I would talk to the crew, that she's like a bull. I'm like in a pen before being let out and they've got my nuts in a vise. And that's what it feels like. It's just this like explosion that she's going to explode and she's got to kind of move back and forth or she'll lose her. Yeah. That's also very true of, you know, just getting ready to go on and get the lines right. And because all of those scenes, the way Amy writes them, it's like an explosion. You know, you have to get in, you've got to lay everything out as fast as you can and get the hell out. And yeah, it's like running a race sometimes.
But it's also too something I definitely think of. You think of like the male comedians who would have been around at the time of Mrs. Maisel, those guys like Alan King or a lot of those guys who are like constantly sort of moving back and forth and building up this kind of weird tension, almost like walking a trench. And there is that kind of tension we expect to see often in stand-up too. We're aware of the physical tension of the performer. And there is an elegance in the way you're moving on stage because it's such a complete thing where you're singing, but you're also offering anecdote. There is not a lot of anxiety, but there's tension in it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think it's the good kind of tension. It's the excitement. But a lot of it too was, you know, we had cameras in very specific places on night one. And then we had cameras in different places on night two. And so a lot of my movement was quite deliberate. You know, there are moments that where there's a surprise here and there if an audience does something, but for the most part, you know, it was very plotted out. It was, you know, every movement, every line had there was blocking to it, like a play. So that definitely was intentional to have it use the space and be comfortable in that space so that the material is what's read and not any nervous energy.
I guess it's interesting too, because in this last season of Maison, I've seen, I guess, all the episodes except for the last episode. We learn a lot about Susie because the one thing I can give away for people who've seen the show, the first couple episodes or so, there's some time shifts in it. Would you talk about sort of playing that character in two different periods and what that was like for you?
I'll tell you, I mean, yeah, we're allowed to kind of talk about some of that now. That was really hard to not talk about before we premiered. That was really jarring. You know, we were all completely surprised when we got the script, you know, and seeing that we were going to try to tackle that was very scary. It was intimidating because it's really hard to predict how physically someone is going to kind of age and fall into their own body in some ways. And with Susie, you know, we talked about how she dressed and it's kind of like a coat of armor. That was one thing that, you know, able to do as she alters, her dress changed quite a bit. Like, she's allowed to get rid of a belt. She's allowed to not be bound up, so to speak, or covered. With some success, she's able to relax into her own body and hold herself differently and slow down. The pacing disappears. So that was super interesting, but also really challenging.
That thing you're talking about, the physicality, because you mentioned her being like a bull, and sometimes she's almost like walking into a situation with her head down just to sort of knock things out of the way. And mm-hmm. she, very close to the ground, in fact, to sort of keep her center of gravity. And in these later episodes, she actually is sort of like, we can see she's kind of grown in stature in her own body, and she's not trying to be so close to the ground anymore. She wants to be seen in a different kind of way.
Susie's always been grounded, but with success, she is able to relax a little bit. She can kind of dig her toes into the ground. I remember that moment in Die Hard. That's a weird thing to quote, right? But but when Bruce Willis is talking to some other guy in the plane about dealing with jet lag, the guy says, take your shoes off and let your feet kind of dig into the carpeting. And I love that this season, that's what Susie gets to do.
It's always great talking to you, Alex. Thank you so much for doing this. My guest is Alex Borstein. Her terrific special on Amazon is Corsets and Clown Suits. Not many places where you hear LCD Sound System and New Order in the same show. And start with a burlesque dance, but it's a terrific show nonetheless. She's also, of course, starring in the last season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is also on Amazon. Alex, again, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Alex Borstein is a voiceover artist, producer, writer, stand-up, and as we see in her Amazon comedy special, Corsets and Clown Suits, singer. She's also an Emmy-winning actor for her role on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is also on Amazon. Find past episodes of The Treatment, which are at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And it's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest has done something kind of unusual in a lot of ways. He made a movie about his dad, and he also made a movie about the power of pop music and popular culture and about what falling in love with that culture does to somebody. The movie is Spinning Gold, and its director is Timothy Scott Bogart. Tim, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a movie about the power of pop, and not just pop music, but pop culture. It's also a movie that reminds me of this old Taylor Hackford movie called The Idolmaker. And I found myself thinking that in watching this movie, I was really reminded of that movie.
In all these years, going back through all the different music biopics and different pieces that sort of played in this kind of world of music history, I actually thought Idolmaker was one of the few that did try to look at the people who were part of the story, not necessarily the story that we all know. And I don't think there was many done like that. And it's one of the things that drove me to tell my father's story, because I do believe he was the character who got lost to history. And I think oftentimes incredibly consequential people who made history do get lost to it in the light of the more shining, clear focuses like the artists themselves.
I wish to say that the movie's about your dad, Neil Bogart, who was the founder of Casablanca Records and had careers as a pop singer and as an actor. But also, too, he struck me as being one of the rare label heads who functioned also as a producer. The movie is admittedly, from his point of view, sort of, well, I'm trying to say that he's an unreliable narrator in his own story.
I think we all are unreliable narrators in our own story. And interestingly, over the decades of research that I did, George Clinton was an unreliable narrator in his story. Donna Summer was an unreliable narrator in hers. Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley. I mean, memories are funny things. And that was something I did want to capture. But clearly, if my father were to be telling the story of his life, there's no question he'd be polishing it up and hiding some of the shadows. And that was something I really did want to capture.
I brought up The Idolmaker too, Timothy, because I thought that's a movie about the romance of the protagonist with pop. And your film, Spinning Gold, is also about that too, about this romantic pull that pop has on people. And being somebody who understood the fundamentals of music and was able to talk to the performers as somebody who understood that, I thought that was a really fascinating way to sort of couch this and to not have him be superior, because he just wanted them to succeed because he loved what it was they were doing and in some part wanted to be in that too. I mean, that thing that's aspiration and not jealousy in him was an interesting thing to base the story on.
That was something we worked really hard on, because I do think that's a critical part of who my father was. There's no question he himself wanted to be an artist. Absolutely no question, as evidenced through his early efforts to actually be a singer and the songs that he did in fact do. And when he acknowledged, I think, that it wasn't the skill that he had above all others, that it did not become jealous. It really did become collaborative with these artists. And I think that's a critical distinction, as you said, as a label executive. It's not just that he was a producer in name. It's that he really was a partner, first identifying what was special about that artist and then supporting that special quality in a way that I don't think anyone ever quite supported at the extremes, perhaps to his detriment, that he did. So he was a guy who saw the gifts in others. And I think his greatest gift was seeing those gifts and then fully and completely and with all of himself partnering with those voices to figure out how to bring them to the world. And that reference to pop culture, you know, I think there's some who think about music history and think pop is a bad word, or driving towards what was culturally important at the moment, sometimes in the moment seems maybe less artistic. I actually think that was also one of my father's great strengths, is he understood what the audience, where the audiences were, what the audience wanted. Even in the earlier career, you know, coming out of the Vietnam War, yes, there was some incredibly important music that was being written about those struggles. But my father also saw a whole group of people who just wanted to check out for a minute, and that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And thus was born bubblegum music, the idea literally of someone just chewing bubblegum on a street corner and yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy. And so I think throughout my father's career, he did identify what was pop, what was culture, and what was important to the masses. And I think to some degree, it's maybe why he was sometimes a little bit ahead of maybe the critical artistic world at the moment, and why, therefore, those artists took a little bit longer to get there.
It's funny, because in watching the movie, I could not think about the advent of the boy bands in the 90s or K-pop, this idea that you can be a producer and create persona, which is what your dad was interested in as well, this idea of creating really this kind of mystique around a performer and an identity that people will identify with as much as the songs, be it Donna Summer or George Clinton and his various iterations at the same time, or Giorgio Moroder, or Kiss, or the Village People. I mean, all these acts were as much persona as they were performance. In the case of Donna Summer and Kiss, people had to get past those persona to realize that they were extremely talented performers.
I think sometimes people view persona over artistry as a bad thing. And I think what my father saw was it was all one thing. It was all about experiencing this music, experiencing these artists. And he did that by looking at the totality of that experience. And those personas were crucial to them. And yes, the idea of understanding Chaim Witz as Gene Simmons, playing the part of Gene Simmons, or Stanley Eisen playing the part of Paul Stanley, or LaDonna Gaines playing the part of Donna Summer, I do think it took time for people to ultimately understand the personas. But I think they were inextricably intertwined in terms of their importance to one another. And I think my father's strength, again, was in seeing that whole and embracing, they weren't his creations in most cases. He saw first the beginning of those ideas. You know, Kiss had that idea. He just took it as far as they wanted it to go. Parliament, of course, George had that idea. He had that persona. Not always. He started as a three-piece suited, you know, doo-wop
singer. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. It's only after he went to Europe and had some life-altering experiences that he came back as the George that we all know and love. But it was identifying those personas as part of the experience, which I do think differentiated him from just about anybody else in the space.
I want to talk to you about Cassin Your Lee, who actually does have a vocal power that your father didn't. And I just thought that was, in your way, casting the dream version of your dad, because if he had actually that kind of bottom in the voice, then those songs would have been more enduring. So talk about that casting, finding him and the vocal call that he has as a singer.
Well, you know, interestingly, it's not technically why I cast Jeremy Jordan that way to play my father, but the moment I had him, I realized that was an extra along. So the picture had been I've been developing it literally for 24 years, not like as a throwaway line. Like really in 1999, I set up the project at the first studio, and there probably wasn't a day in those 24 years I wasn't pushing that boulder up the hill. So I had gone through other actors, other people, widely known. I was developing with Justin Timberlake for a while. But in this iteration, we were about 2 months away from production, and I had cast every other role in the film.
Wow.
And my producing partners were like, you know, you should probably cast your dad at some point. Like, we're getting pretty close, and he is the lead. But I couldn't commit, and I understandably why I couldn't necessarily commit. But I had actually been literally one call away from casting a wonderful actor, incredible performer, well-known guy. True story, I woke up in the middle of the night, the night before I was going to call him and commit to this other actor that we were going to do the film together. And I just had this crisis of conscience that I was missing something essential about my father's talent to own a room as a performer. I had found an actor who could get all the colors and the layers and all that. But my father, not necessarily singing, walked into a business meeting and captured everybody in that room and swept them all away. And that was something that was performative. That was something that I think did come from his early years of wanting to be on stage and all the rest of that. And this other actor just, no fault on this actor, just wasn't that kind of performer. It was a film performer, not a stage performer. So I woke up that morning and I called my producing partner, Larry Mark, you know, who had done Dreamgirls and Greatest Showman.
Sure.
Larry, I made a terrible mistake. Here's a different question. Who is the absolute best Broadway performer that can take any stage and own the entire audience for 2 hours every night? And he said, Jeremy Jordan. And I said, I have absolutely no idea who that is.
Well, really? So you know? Oh my gosh.
I had no idea who Jeremy was. So I ran to YouTube and literally spent about 6 hours going down a YouTube rabbit hole watching these more cabaret-like performance that Jeremy does, where he does these small venue performances. And this kid takes a stage, and yes, vocally, he is a powerhouse, unrivaled, I think, at the moment on Broadway. But it was more than that. It was his storytelling between the songs, where he just wraps you up in this conjured image that he tells and owns you for that whole night that you're with him. And that was what I thought my father ultimately really did. He wrapped people up in the dream. And so I saw this guy who I'd never seen any of his work. I lost myself on YouTube. I took the next night, the red eye to New York, didn't even know how to connect with Jeremy yet. But by the time I had landed, I had had enough people reach around to different agencies, found out where he was, and convinced him to meet with me. And he was rather shocked because he hadn't done a lead of this nature on a film before like that. We held a secret read-through in New York where we got a bunch of other theater friends of his and mine who are currently on Broadway to do a private reading. And I cast him at that moment. But I cast him for the essence of the performer. And then once we were really working on it, the idea that this film was not a movie musical, but was always going to be an extraordinarily musical movie started to reveal itself as Jeremy and I worked together. And I kept adding other moments for him to explore more musicality and more performance space. So it started with a different idea and certainly evolved to that. But one of the greatest creative decisions I've ever made.
The other thing I think that's sort of key to what Casablanca and also Buddha did was there's so much kick drum in those songs. There's so much boom, 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 boom from Imagination by Gladys Knight to you think about Hot Stuff and how it's Harold Faltermeyer doubling on bass and on drums. So he's basically on the one on both of them. And that bottom shaking suffuses the entire film in music terms, doesn't it?
It sure does. And there was a scene that we ended up not including in the film, but when he was working with Ron Isley for It's Your Thing, my father did this thing, I guess isn't really done anymore because of digital, but where he cut the record hot. By that, he meant he went to the manufacturer and said, I know that these are the levels that you're not allowed to go above for quality control. You're going to make them higher by this amount. And the reason he did that is so when you were sitting in your car listening to the radio, whatever the song was before, the moment It's Your Thing came on, it cut hot, sounded bigger, better. And then the next song that came in after It's Your Thing sounded just somehow diminished. So it was a complete trick of literally grabbing that bass and that bump and even messing with the way you would manufacture an album to heighten that, I think became something early on that my father thought was important. And he just kept making things louder and more arresting to differentiate it from the rest.
Every song had an entrance. In effect, each song had kind of like an introduction. Not a fanfare, but, you know, It's Your Thing basically is about, it's almost a full measure before anybody starts to sing. But the way basically your dad played with time, and that's also in the story, too.
There was never just a song. A song was part of a bigger idea. It was part of a persona of an act, as we talked about. It was part of an album. You know, you had mentioned earlier about this whole idea of the album. Ultimately, when I was really wrestling with how best to tell this story, and I kept wrestling with where do you enter, where do you end, I sort of landed on this idea that if my father were telling his own tale, he would just cut to the chase and say, let me just give you my greatest hits. And once I had that idea, the idea that he was then sequencing, which we don't really do anymore because of the world of singles, he was sequencing an album to tell us the story of his life. And the sum of his life was made up by the specific tracks that are on that vinyl and in the specific order that he wanted us to experience them with. So all the presentation of music, in real life for him, and in the way I tried to pay honor to him in the movie, was about something that was connected to the last thing and leading you to the next thing. It was never just its own thing. It was all a much larger experience.
So much of what Casablanca was, we should remember the original name of the company was Casablanca Music and Film Works. So obviously at some point, your father wanted to sort of include all of media in what he was doing. And that at that point where music wasn't really a part of the film world, or wasn't taken seriously in the film world, that your father was somebody who understood both marketing and art. in this way that now is the way the music world works. But it wasn't then.
It was such a pioneering idea, and especially connecting music and film. I mean, you know, when they were doing The Deep and Peter Guber, who would eventually become partners with my father in Casablanca Records and Filmworks, the idea of Donna Summer doing that song was one thing. The idea of Giorgio Moroder to do a movie, when they then did Midnight Express, the idea of Giorgio Moroder doing Midnight Express, I mean, it was so the last idea anyone would ever have, but those things became incredibly important culturally at that time. So his ability to see movie and music as one thing as well, I do think was unique, but so was the extension of the Kiss Army and the idea of merchandising. That was way before its time. The idea of the Kiss Army, where you would become part of this special group. If first you bought the albums, then you got the access. It was all always this idea of how to get past the red carpet and become part of something that normally you wouldn't be able to. And interestingly, you know, after Casablanca, he did start another company called Boardwalk. And Boardwalk was really dedicated to this multimedia idea. And sadly, at the time of his passing, he had a Broadway show. He was doing the Jackie Robinson musical on Broadway. He was into television at that time. They were into merchandising. They were into animation. So he absolutely saw all of it as one thing. And I do think it was way before its time.
One of the things that I think the movie doesn't make a big deal out of, but it's clearly a part of one of the reasons that I think your dad wasn't taken seriously, was that he worked with a lot of black acts at a time when there was certainly a kind of institutional interest in black acts. We can call it racism now, but the Isleys, who went on to found their own label and became huge centers of pop culture, and Gladys Knight, who found new purchase after walking away from being disregarded at Motown. And you deal with this in ways that isn't about sort of beating people over the head with it, but the fact is there was certainly a kind of a racism in the way that your dad was dealt with and not taken seriously.
I think that's true on a number of fronts. I mean, I think on the one hand, also as a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, he was already on his own kind of diminished to some degree in his sphere. And then, yes, for whatever reason, even going back to Cameo Parkway Records, and then certainly through Buddha, so many of those acts were acts that had felt marginalized. And by the way, marginalized at Motown, which was iconic at that moment, the place that's where you would want to be if you were an African-American act, but not really. They didn't really, those acts at that time, have their own individualized voices. Motown, of course, you know, is one of the most consequential labels of all time, so no one should ever, you know, diminish their impact. But the truth also is the songwriters were writing for all of the different acts, and whoever was at the top of the heap at that moment would get the best songs. That's absolutely why Gladys wanted to leave. She wasn't getting the best music. I think Ron Isley for sure felt that he had so much more to say, not just in music, but in politics, to be embraced the way he wanted to be embraced, regardless of what the powers that be felt at that time. I think that he found kind of a limiting factor where he was, and same with Curtis. And so interestingly, at the time of Buddha at its height, a lot of people thought my father was actually a black executive because most of his most important acts were African-American artists. And I think that kind of connectivity of this little Jewish kid and these incredibly important African-American artists all kind of fell into the, we don't know what that is. So I think there was a diminishment across the board. But I also think my father just had a way of connecting to something that was so honestly embraced by the masses. And I think a lot of people diminish that. So when you look at his work with bubblegum music, when you look at his work with disco, at each one of those places, I think people diminish the music itself, not just from a racial standpoint, but I think they just felt this was music that was appealing to the masses, or appealing to specific groups that were longing for that kind of music that was more reflective of themselves. And it didn't necessarily go directly towards what the critics were saying was the most important thing at that moment, but the people were saying it was the most important thing to them. And I think in many ways, my father's commitment to the fans and providing music that they really wanted to hear and that spoke to them in very individual ways was diminished, and diminished him as an executive. I think that's one of the reasons he was lost to history.
Well, he won't be anymore thanks to your movie. It's quite a film, Timothy. I can't thank you enough for talking to me about this. My guest is Timothy Scott Bogart. His movie about his father, Neil Bogart, I think one of the most important figures in the history of popular culture, not just pop music. The film is Spinning Gold. Again, Timothy, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Director Tim Bogart's film, Spinning Gold, is on the life of his father, Casablanca Records founder Neil Bogart. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Stay with us. It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. From Marc Maron, actor, comic, and podcaster, comedy inspirations from the man who gave us the HBO special, From Bleak to Dark.
I'm Marc Maron. This is The Treat.
Would you please welcome Mr. Warmth, Don Rickles.
Lately, as I get older as a comic, and I realize that, you know, I've been doing this for most of my life, I really find myself sometimes just sitting at home and watching old comedy clips. I mean, really old, like, you know, like Rodney Dangerfield, like Buddy Hackett, like Don Rickles.
I went to the gate and I came in.
The gate,
Harry.
What do you mean the gate here?
The gate? No, the gate at San Quentin.
Why? Well, I see.
What the hell's the matter with you?
Studio
when you're
gate.
On 26 years, you're starting to be like Reagan, huh? Anyway.
These were the guys when I was a kid, when my grandmother or my grandfather, I'd be sitting at their house or they'd be telling me about, you know, what they thought was funny. My grandmother loved Don Rickles, loved Buddy Hackett. My grandfather was more of a slapstick guy, but it really informed who I was. And when I was a little kid, probably 10 or 11, I would watch comics on television. I used to see Jackie Vernon. It must have been on the Dean Martin shows. And I thought he was the funniest guy in the world, to the point where my parents, I must have been 11 or 12, and they knew I loved this guy. They brought me to a nightclub at the Hilton Hotel in Albuquerque, New Mexico, because Jackie Vernon was playing. And I sat right up front. I was the only kid in the place. They let my parents bring me in. And I'm sitting there 5 feet from Jackie Vernon, this, you know, heavy set, sweaty guy.
Now, here you are, Dean, just starting out in show business. And there's the elephant trainer handing you the shovel. And there's the first room you ever played in. And that's a husband chasing out the window.
I thought the slideshow thing was so funny because the whole bit was a clicker to a slideshow that he described. And I thought it was genius, and I thought it was hilarious to me.
Here you are making a record with a girl singer. Here's Frank Sinatra with the same girl breaking a record.
For some reason, lately, I've been watching when I want to feel better or if I want to just, you know, really reflect on what comedy used to be. And it took me a long time to appreciate this guy because I don't think as a kid I really registered Dangerfield that much, but I like watching Rodney on Carson, like the old stuff, because Rodney not doing well was the greatest thing in the world. Like where he'd be like, are you sure this mic's the right mic?
Really? As a kid, I never got the breaks either, never.
This has been following you all your life, you mean?
I was rough when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I was a kid the first time I had my picture taken. The pony threw me. Another one I should have
You
tried.
Gotta try him out of town, no. Right? You can't bring him in.
Take him on a road to you. Take him on a road. You gotta break right. Him in.
You know, I guess there's part of me that's like kind of realizing that I am. This is part of my life, and I love comedians. I've always loved comedians. You know, so I find myself, you know, watching old comedy, and I still like. I find a lot of inspiration from watching my contemporaries. You know, oddly, it's very funny. Like I watched Nate Bargatze's new special, and he used to open for me. I remember the first time I saw him, I was like, I watched him 3 or 4 times at a comedy festival. I'm like, does anyone know who this kid is? Because he's got a style that's like totally unique. But the funny thing is that, you know, him and I, you know, politically and spiritually are very different. You know, he's Southern, he's Christian, you know, he definitely doesn't have the politics I have, but we're friends, and I really truly love his comedy. And you know, we couldn't be more different. You know, he's clean. Like, I'm the opposite of Nate. But he opened for me at Carnegie Hall. But it's so funny because I watched his newest special, and I swear to God, I find him inspiring.
It's because your brain, like, you have left brain and you have right brain. And one part of your brain is super smart, and the other part is dumb as rocks. And I think that's true. Look, I don't, anything I say up here does not come from a building of education. This is all stuff I've overheard at Target or Lowe's.
But I texted him, and I was like, you know, look, I know we think differently about things, and, you know, we're spiritually different, but I love you, man. I thought the special was great. And he texted back, I pray for you every day. And he said, I love you too, man. I miss you. I hope we can hang out again. You know, it's really part of being this community. And also, like, I recently worked with Maria Bamford up in Canada. We were in the same venue. Like, there, you know, I was working with her. I got to watch her, like, four times because we were in the same venue up in Canada. And I've known her forever, you know, and I've always, like, sung her praises. But, like, she is still working at the top of her game. And it's a game that no one else can play. And it's deep, and it covers everything in a way that's just totally inspired and unique, to the point where you watch her and I'm like, why am I even doing comedy?
That's all we talk about. What are you working on these days? What's going on with you? What's on the next page for you? What's coming up for you? What are you working on?
Oh, I'm done. Yeah, I finished early.
So I still get a lot of inspiration, and I spend my life in comedy clubs still. You know, I'm at the Comedy Store. You know, if I'm in town, I'm there three or four nights a week, and I'm in it, you know. And I still find it, you know, engaging, and there are still acts that I'm very excited to watch, and I find it inspiring, and it keeps me on my game. You know?
Wow. That was great. I think that's all I needed. I gotta remember that. I gotta remember that. Thank you very much.
The Treat on Comedy from comic and podcaster Mark Maron. Past treats feature other comedians such as Chris Redd. Listen at kcrw.com/thetreat. In the mood for award nominees and winners? They're at kcrw.com/FYC. And The Treat, it's flashes of inspiration that set creators of all fields of endeavor off on their paths and enlighten ours. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help this week from the able hands of Anna Buss, Laura Kondarajan, and Nick Lamponi. To better days, everyone, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.